The county's number one talk show, the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio.
And now it's time for the talk of the Northwest, the 9 to noon show with Greg Hughes on Highland Radio.
Hello, very good morning to you. Just approaching 4 minutes past nine on this Friday, the 9th of June, 2023. You're very welcome along to another 9 till noon show. And it's a busy one as always, lots to squeeze in. But we're going to kick off the first hour with our Friday panel. I'll introduce them to you in just a moment, but just to invite you to get involved in the conversation as well and to have your say. The WhatsApp and text line is now open. It's 086 60 25000. Truth be told, it never closes. You can also give us a call on 07491 25000, 07491 25000. And we welcome your emails via comments@highlandradio.com. And if you want to interact with us on social media, of course, you can watch the programme on YouTube, Highland Radio Ireland, across our Facebook pages, that is Highland Hub, Highland News and Sport. We're on Twitter as well. And also watch live on our website. Okay, let's say good morning to Professor Pat O'Connor, Professor of Sociology and Social Policy Emeritus at University of Limerick. Good to have you with us again. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Greg.
Great to have you on board as always. And Senator Lisa Chambers, leader of the Seanad and spokesperson on European and Foreign Affairs with Fianna Fáil. Lisa, great to see you again. Good morning to you.
Morning, Greg.
And we have a third guest who will be joining us shortly, so we'll introduce them just as soon as we get them connected. A quick one here. Micheál Martin's insisted he'll be leading Fianna Fáil into the next general election. The Taoiseach was responding to suggestions he may seek to become the state's next EU commissioner when the position becomes vacant in mid-2024. Speculation around Mr. Martin's future has also seen him linked to a potential tilt at the presidency of Ireland, but he reaffirmed his pledge to lead Fianna Fáil into the next general election as he faced media questions on a visit to Belfast on Wednesday. I've been asked about different positions and so on. I'm leading the party into the next general election. Good news, Lisa.
Yeah, good on him. He's fairly put that to bed. Look, there's a lot of speculation about the commissioner role for next year, and as you said, a tilt to the presidency, but you know, the best person to answer that question is the man himself, and he was asked directly and he has said he's leading us into the next election. So until you know, he says otherwise, that's the position, and I'm very happy with that. I think he's an asset to the party. And I think, you know, in his time as Taoiseach during the pandemic, I think a lot of people said he did a good job, even non-Fianna Fáil people. And I think he's been doing a good role as Taoiseach as well. So, yeah, I'm happy to hear that. And it's up to himself when he wants to move forward.
And do you think that would be the general sense within the party? I mean, you're always going to get clusters of councillors or some, you know, renegade backbenchers that might have a different view. But do you think that's the sort of the consensus within Fianna Fáil?
I do. I think the consensus within Fianna Fáil, the consensus within the party would be that really it's a matter for himself when he wants to step aside and wants to move on to something else. Obviously, there's a lot of chat within the party about those rumours about the commissioner role for next year and the presidency. But the view would be broadly, not everybody, but the vast majority would be that he's done a good job and people are quite happy with him at the helm as leader.
You'd forgive him, though, for moving on if he wished to, wouldn't you? I mean, he's climbed as high as you can, I suppose, in Irish politics. I presume he always had an aspiration to lead the country. He's done that now. You know, his name will be forever etched in history and people will have different interpretations of that, of course. There's not much really for him to achieve. He could be flogging a dead horse trying to form the next government. You know, I mean, as I say, riding off into the sunset for an EU commissioner's job, I think if I were his advisor, I might suggest he do so.
Well, you know, obviously being a commissioner is a huge job and it will be amazing to do it, I'm sure. But, you know, don't underestimate Micheál Martin's love of public life and his commitment to the job. I've not encountered anybody in my time in politics with the work ethic and the commitment to the role. You know, it's rare you come across somebody that it's their life, it's what they do. So don't underestimate that element of it. But look, as I said, you know, you can't stay anywhere forever. He's going to go at some point, but it's a matter for himself when he goes, and the vast majority of the party are quite happy to have him as leader for as long as he wants to be there.
And finally, before I bring Pat in, I think the timing of this, you know, we aren't that far away from an election. It would be quite disruptive to Fianna Fáil, I suppose, if he were to change his mind now. So I presume we can presume that he has actually made, as much as anyone can in the moment, a firm decision on this. It's not something you'd be playing with, because it would be quite damaging if he decided then at between now and the next election to move on, I think. Lisa?
Yeah, oh, sorry, is that to me? Sorry, Greg. Well, the next election is the European elections and the local elections. So I think we can fairly take it that that's set. And, you know, the Dáil elections, if the government runs the full term, it's got another 2 years to go. It's a long, long time in politics, you know. So, but as I said, it's up to the man himself to decide when he's ready to move forward and move on to something else. And I've no doubt he'll have plenty of opportunities in the next chapter of his life whenever that comes along.
All right, Pat O'Connor. Good morning to you again. What's your view on all this?
Well, I think he has to say he's going to go on, otherwise he becomes a lame duck. I do think that the results of the election will be critical in him making his decision. I have no inside track on Fianna Fáil or Micheál Martin's thoughts, but obviously I think if Fianna Fáil are do very well at the next elections, he may well think, well, if there's a possibility of forming a government, my money would be on him continuing. However, on the other hand, if, as seems likely, Sinn Féin are going to be the dominant party, I think he'll bow out. But as I say, I have no inside track on this.
That's providing, of course, Sinn Féin can maintain their momentum that they appear to have. Pat, as Lisa pointed out, it's potentially 2 years to the next general election. An awful lot can happen in that time.
Oh, absolutely. And I do notice that Mary Lou MacDonald has been downplaying elements that might be problematic for a middle-class constituency, i.e. United Ireland, although everybody knows that's really an important objective of Sinn Féin. So I do think Sinn Féin have been playing a very clever game. So I guess, you know, I'm not a betting woman, but if I were, my money would be on Sinn Féin, and hence the implications of that for Micheál Martin's continuance in power. But in the meantime, he has to say until the very last moment that, yes, he's staying, because otherwise, you know, power leaks away and he becomes a lame duck.
At what point do you think, Pat, the public will start questioning Sinn Féin? You know, about how can you fix everything that you've committed to fixing? How are you actually going to fund it? What might be the timeline for delivering everything that you've promised that you might be able to deliver? Do you know what I mean? I think there's a presumption at this point that there is surely going to come a point, not maybe for people that have always voted Sinn Féin, but those that are sort of considering it as an option, whereby people are going to want a little bit more information on this stuff. Now, I respect that someone in Sinn Féin might say that's out there, but, you know, you can't promise that. You have to at some point say, well, exactly how are you going to deliver the sun, the moon and the stars?
Well, in a way, I think, you see, there's a kind of a fantasy element. People are acutely aware of housing, of health, education, the problems, particularly in housing and health. So they want to believe, there's a fantasy element, they want to believe that everything will be okay. So I think that probably Sinn Féin will sail under the fantasy until perhaps 6 months before the election, and then tough questions may begin to be asked. But I think in the meantime, people are so tired, frustrated, angry, upset, that in a way, the only, and they can't see a solution like to things like housing and health. And so in a way, the only refuge is fantasy. It's going to be okay. Somehow we're going to magically solve the problem. Somebody is going to solve the problem. And I think that is facilitating Sinn Féin's rise. And I think they will cruise under that until, I estimate, 6 months before the general election. Yeah. But I could be wrong.
It'd also be interesting to see what turnout might be in that. Do people believe politics can fix all of the problems that you talk of? Pleased to say Dr. Andrea Redmond, artist and community development worker, has joined us now. Good morning to you, Andrea. Great to have you on board today.
Thank you, Greg. It's great to be here.
We were just having a conversation here, and we're going to move on after we hear from you. Micheál Martin is insisting he's staying on to lead Fianna Fáil into the next general election. As Lisa Chambers pointed out, that could be 2 years away. But for now, that's his decision. Were you surprised to learn that? Happy? I don't know.
No, To be perfectly honest, I think would we miss him? I hate to be cheeky and facetious, but I'm sure he's looking longingly down the road to the day when he can be on a golf course, possibly playing doubles with Leo in a galaxy far, far away. Because really, what difference has he made to Donegal? And this government now, I think they can see the writings on the wall. I think we were discussing Sinn Féin and what can they do to change things? Could they make it any worse than it already is? I mean, the situation is just dire. When we have, for example, a woman at the minute who's fighting, dying of cervical cancer, fighting in court, have we learned nothing? We have people who are homeless here in Donegal, housing situation. Can things be any worse? There's a sea change coming, and I'm hoping to see fresh faces, including Sinn Féin, a lot more independence from Donegal, and hopefully maybe a brighter future.
And do you believe that a brighter future will be delivered after the next general election?
It couldn't be any worse, can it? I mean, look at the situation that we're in. We're inviting refugees to this country to live in tents. This country is being fined by the UN for its treatment of refugees. Recently, there's just a story there of a man, an elderly man from Offaly, who's been living in his car for the last 4 weeks. I mean, is there no humanity in this government? And it just seems that they have forgotten the people in the West. They've forgotten the people in Donegal. Whatever will happen, whatever sea change, whatever face replaces Micheál or Leo, the impact to Donegal will be minimal. It'll be the Mandarins in Dublin who make these decisions. The mica crisis, where else, could that have happened? They've literally left Donegal in the cold. Mm. Now, I have to say that the local councillors in Glenties especially, across all parties, have been excellent and very supportive. But I just think Dublin is just a place onto itself, and it just does not hear
all right,
ordinary
just, human beings. I get you. Just before the break, and to move on, just for a bit of a counterbalance to that, I mean, the one thing we have to recognise as well is that if you look at the polls, and you combine Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael and the Greens, even at this point, things aren't looking too bad for them. Approval ratings for the leaders are so-so. So, in other words, there's no guarantees that these parties are going to be wiped out after the next general election. But Senator Chambers, we don't invite you on to defend the government, but obviously you're a member of Fianna Fáil. Mm-hmm. What do you think of that assessment, Dr. Redmond's assessment of the country, that things couldn't get any worse? Maybe it doesn't tell. I can understand how people might feel that, especially here in the Northwest, but perhaps it doesn't tell the full story either.
I respect her views, and she's entitled to her opinions, of course, and I would disagree with that. I live in the west of Ireland as well. I'm living in Mayo, and I think we have very similar challenges to Donegal and the west and northwest region. But some of the positives about the country at the minute: we have the best performing economy in the European Union, we have the best life expectancy in the European Union, we were ranked fourth in the world in terms of best place to live. So there's lots of really good things about Ireland, and lots of really good things about how our country is working and is being run. I'm not suggesting there aren't challenges, of course there are, and housing is the obvious one, but as a country we're when you compare us to other countries, we're doing really, really well in lots of aspects. And if you look at healthcare, for example, we've just recently gotten a commitment from this government to build a brand new regional cancer centre for the West and Northwest that will be looking after Donegal patients and Mayo patients. We've been looking for this for more than a decade, and we've just gotten that commitment 2 weeks ago. So, there's lots of good things happening. I'm not saying there aren't challenges. Of course there are. And I think, when you talk about polling, yes, support for the government is holding. There was polling done as well on the issue of housing. Did people believe that a change of government would fix the housing crisis, and people didn't buy into that. So, I think people understand that the housing situation, it's going to be a long-term issue for us to deal with. And my view is that the plan that's currently in place is turning the Titanic. But we've had a decade of undersupply that we're trying to catch up on. And that's proving a big challenge, because on top of that, we've had 100,000 Ukrainian and international protection refugees come in the space of 12 months, which is it's just an astronomical number. Like it's so far beyond what we would have been dealing with previously. We had maybe 3,000 coming in. So that challenge for our country, and every country is feeling this. This is not just Ireland. You know, 100,000 people in 12 months, it's just an extraordinary number of people to try and deal with on top of a housing challenge that was already there. So overall, I think dealing with refugees, and I know there, again, there's been some people that haven't had accommodation when they've come in, but the vast majority have been accommodated. We can be proud of ourselves for doing, I think, a very good job in just extraordinary difficult circumstances.
Yeah, Pat, the more people I speak to in areas such as housing, education and health, and it's mostly off the records, the frustration with the permanent government or elements of the civil service. Is a party that calls that out and challenges to change that, perhaps things might resonate more with the public? Because I think the public, and we heard Andrea reference that as well, I think the public are sort of starting to see, you know, who is making a lot of the decisions, who's holding things up, where the frustrations lie. Like in terms of investment into education, you know, in the Northwest, I think it's 100 euro per head less per student. You know, we've no professors north of a Dublin-Galway line. Things like that, that aren't government decisions. The civil service decisions are elements of that. And more you dig into it, you see that that's the case. So I think a party that highlights that and challenges that, Pat, might do very well.
Well, that's possible. I mean, in a way, I suppose the difficulty is once a party is in government and they start basically calling out the civil service, they may find it difficult to get cooperation of the civil service. And most parties are aware of that. I suppose the scandal that has brought this to a lot of people's minds is Robert Watt, the Secretary General in the Department of Health, who appears to be indifferent to his minister and indifferent to any other opinion. In the case of education, I mean, the technological, I don't know what people in Donegal think about the development of the technological universities, whether they see that as a plus or a minus, which was driven by the Higher Education Authority, and the OECD, there's an OECD report which will actually change the positions within the technological universities so that there will be professors if those recommendations are accepted. But I do think that there should be more accountability of civil servants, that those, particularly at Secretary General level, who make decisions, that those decisions should be accountable for them, and that who is making them should be clear. So I suppose what is interesting is that though that in some departments the ministers seem to be able to utilise the permanent secretariat more effectively than in other departments. So there are issues surrounding those relationships, but the discord and disunity seems most obvious in the Department of Health. And I do think the payment to salary to Robert Watt was absolutely, the whole thing was really, the fact that he is the most, his payment, how he was selected, the whole scenario was very, very, very strange.
And I think really just with the way the whole defective concrete redress thing is playing out too, I think a lot of people sort of see that in housing as well. But I take your point. That was the voice there of Professor Pat O'Connor. We're also in the company of Senator Lisa Chambers and Dr. Andrea Redmond, and we'll hear more from all of our guests after this quick break. Yesterday, People Before Profit have started their argument that young adults should be paid the full minimum wage. At present, those aged 20 and over must be paid at least 11.30 an hour. Those 19 are entitled to 10.17. 18-year-olds can be paid 9.04. Those under 18 earn 7.91. People Before Profit has drafted an Equal Pay for Young Workers Bill 2022 that would equalise rates of pay across all age groups. And perhaps it's just because I have sons that are of that age now, and I see them, the hours that they're working, and the fact that they have been earning the lower whilst working the same job beside others that are getting a higher rate, I find it a little unfair. So I do have kind of skin in the game on this one. But let's see what our guests think. Dr. Andrea Redmond, what say you?
I agree totally. It's discriminatory. And I think, you know, when you have the unions unite or behind the motion, you have Social Justice Ireland, the Children's Rights Alliance are behind it. I think in this day and age, young people are out, they're paying car loans, they're saving for university. I think it's very unfair. I myself, and I think a lot of us, work to put ourselves through university. And, you know, the struggle of studies and part-time work, and then to be paid, you know, a lower minimum wage. Also, young people in apprenticeships are paid scantily. Young people who are on job seekers are paid less than adults. I think it's time that, you know, there was fair and there was equality and pay.
So you can't see any argument for retaining these minimum wage structures as they stand?
Well, some of the arguments they'll throw that it will impact small businesses and that. And a lot of the work that young people do, you know, are jobs that older people really, you know, may not want. And when, you know, what they're saying too is, you know, the young people that they're learning, like an apprentice are learning, but they're actually carrying out a day's work and deserve a day's pay. And when you have people like the unions backing this motion and such strong organizations and voices in Ireland, I can't see why there would be a big issue.
Is there something of a separation here in that, say, for instance, someone was doing a welding apprenticeship, that they might require extra time and oversight, and maybe there's an argument for them receiving a little less for that because they're not up to maybe the skill set of those working there, compared to maybe someone in retail or hospitality, that there's a shorter lead in to the, you know, to them being upskilled to the same level as of others there? I mean, is there separate arguments for those two areas, do you think, Andrea?
I think it can be looked at. I think certainly that, you know, case by case, but you know, they are, from what I hear from people whose children are on apprenticeships, their rate of pay is dire and it's very difficult for them, you know, and yes, maybe they're learning, but they are also working and contributing to the employer.
All right. So what do you think, Professor Pat O'Connor?
Well, I think, clearly discrimination on the grounds of age or gender or anything else is problematic. It's wrong. End of, right? So basically deciding that people 17, 18, 19 and 20 on the basis of their age should be paid less it's actually illegal. It's wrong, right? Yeah. I do think the case can be made that if people have less experience or less skills, then on that basis, yes, you can decide to pay them less. So in a way, it's up to the industry to indicate what are the skills which are needed and why, how is it, or whether those who are 17, 18, 19, 20 lack those skills. And if they do, then okay, fair enough, they're paid less. But the idea, I mean, we had discrimination on the grounds of, you know, married women couldn't be paid. We've had compulsory mandatory retirement, which is wrong. Again, it's on the basis of age. And we still have an equal pay gap. But it seems Irish society can't get its head around the idea that discrimination means basically not paying people on the basis of their ability to do the job, but on the basis of some other characteristic. And I suppose the surprising thing is that people have only woken up to that now in the KCMQ.
Yeah, okay. Lisa Chambers, what do you think?
Yeah, I would certainly support the principle of equal pay for equal work. And I think that's what it should come down to. So probably on the same page as you, Greg, around, I think apprenticeships are, it's well recognised that, you know, you're not fully qualified yet. You're not fully skilled in a particular job. You require supervision, oversight, and you're learning a trade. So I have no difficulty with somebody not getting the full wage in those circumstances. You know, it's the same if you go to college to qualify as a nurse or any other profession, you don't get paid the full wage or anything in the first instance. So that, I don't have an issue with that personally. But I do have an issue with if somebody's working as a waitress, which is what I did for a decade when I was going through college and school and all the rest of it, or bar work. There's an argument maybe for the first 6 months when you're learning the ropes, because you are that bit slower and you still need to be watched and minded a bit. But after that, I don't think there's a, if you start waitressing as I did when I was 16, I don't see how you could be on a reduced wage for 4 years because you're well able at that stage. So I think that this definitely merits consideration. It will get pushback from the business community, if we're honest about it. We know this. There will be a strong lobby from that perspective. I would have some sympathy for the smaller coffee shops and pubs that have a small limited staff and their margins wouldn't be the same as the bigger guys. So it'll just need to be worked through on that basis. But I do think, certainly when I listen to comments around the gender pay gap as well, it's hard to argue. I would always argue that women get paid less because they do, and we know that it's 14% of a pay gap for women and men in this country, that we shouldn't have an age gap as well. So once it's equal work and you're fully qualified and fully trained, you should be getting the same wages.
Yeah, and I mean I would sympathise with the small businesses that you reference, but they can't necessarily survive off the back of young people and exploiting them, because they will favour employing young people because it's cheaper. And that will obviously, then there are older people that don't get employed and they're discriminated against in a way as well. Would you agree, Andrea?
Yeah, that's actually the argument the Unite is making, that employers are employing low-paid young people over the backs of maybe older workers, and so they're being excluded. So that's the argument that Unite is making at the moment.
Yeah, okay. And do you see change in this regard? I mean, there's a couple of other European countries have got rid of it, Pat. Obviously there'll be some resistance, but is there an inevitability about this?
I think the fact that it is named now, there is an inevitability. And really, like, it is unthinkable to say that if you run a business, you must run it taking into account all your costs. And if you can't run it profitably, then you're out of business. I'm sorry. It is untenable to think you can break the law because you want your business to survive, you know? I mean, anybody, for example, if you suggested that really business owners should be free to deal in stolen goods so that they could be viable businesses, people would say, no, of course not. Yeah. So in a way, like, the viability of business is the owner's problem. It can't be done again. Businesses can't be basically maintained if they break the law.
And in fairness to Lisa, you didn't suggest that. I think you said you would appreciate the pressure it would put these businesses on. You didn't say it to justify its retention, just to be clear.
Just to be clear, and obviously the businesses are not breaking the law currently, because that is perfectly legal to pay those reduced rates, because that is what's been set in policy by the state. So that the businesses are not breaking the law currently. And I suppose they've set up their staffing structure and their business on the basis that is the going rate. So you just need to give businesses a bit of time to adjust to changes like that, because it would be a significant change. And I don't think that's insurmountable. And certainly I would agree that, I think businesses will probably look at this and say, I think they can see the change is going to come. And we'll just make those changes.
Yeah, because you have 18-year-olds working one or two years in a place, and then there's other people, just because they're older, coming in instantly on, a couple, 3 euro higher than them. I mean, it must be very demoralising and not a great way to sort of start your working life, Andrea.
No, it's not. And it's discriminatory. And having lived in Canada, there's not an equal. Is this done elsewhere? I don't think so. I mean, minimum wage was minimum wage, whether you were 16 or you were 35.
I think there are sliding scales elsewhere, but there are a couple of sort of our neighbours that have got rid of it more recently, Andrew, if I'm correct. I don't have that data just in front of me, but I don't think it's unprecedented. I don't think we're outliers, or at least we weren't in the past. A caller says, on a matter of profound change, the Irish people should have their say. There should be a referendum on mass immigration. Can Ireland say no? What do you think about that, Lisa? I mean, I'm not sure really about the wording of the question, but what we did learn is that 75% of the population, and it's an old survey now, so we won't stay long on it, had concerns about the level of immigration or how immigration was being handled. As I say, I think how a question is phrased is incredibly important in these matters. But be that as it may, there are a lot of people that have their concerns. Now, does this government or another government have to address that, or do they have to sort of say, right, we understand that that's how you feel, but this is what we have to do?
I wouldn't support a referendum on immigration. I think that would be very divisive. And, you know, referenda in this country is reserved for constitutional change, where we want to change our constitution. But dealing with the question that was asked, you know, there's a lot of concern around immigration. I would have some of those concerns myself. It's putting pressure on services and on our country. You know, and then we obviously have a moral and legal obligation to take people in, and particularly international protection. If somebody puts a foot on Irish soil, you have an international legal obligation to process them. It's the same for every country, well, not just Ireland.
We opted into that, though, Lisa, didn't we? We did opt into that. It's not something we're bound by. It's something we chose to partake in.
Well, yeah, but I mean, most first world countries would be in the same. Yeah, so I don't think we want to step away from that. But, you know, we are looking. I mean, you probably saw the story yesterday where the memo to cabinet to actually pay a financial contribution to the EU as opposed to taking in 350 international protection applicants. So we're availing of that voluntary solidarity mechanism that was agreed at the EU last year. So we are trying to stem the flow and reduce the numbers coming in. It is leveling off to a certain extent. I think most of the refugees coming in the last year are from Ukraine, which is understandable, and God love them. I think what they're going through is just horrific. But many of those people will want to go home as soon as they can as well. And there will be a rebuilding effort in Ukraine. So we just hope that the war will come to an end sooner rather than later. But it's going to be an ongoing challenge, Greg, if we need to be honest about it as a country, whether it's war in Ukraine or whether it's Syria, whether it's climate migration. Migration is going to be a massive challenge for the European Union, for the world in the coming decades because of those issues. So we are going to have, I think, more of an open and honest conversation as the country as to how we want to deal with this.
Yeah, and maybe ask ourselves actually what we're doing at the moment. How is it affecting us as an individual? Because I think and this is not to take one side or other, but we seem to have an awful lot of conversation about what could happen but what actually is happening? How has people's lives changed as a result of this action that we're taking? Do you know, it seems, and I mean, even messages coming in like, look what happened in France yesterday. This is in relation to the Syrian refugee, the awful attack on children over in France. But people are sort of saying, well, that's what we'll get. Do you know what I mean? Like,
well,
rather
I don't. Yeah, like, I don't buy into that. I mean, there are bad people everywhere. And, you know, it's not surprising that if you have a huge number of people coming in that you might get one, you know, or two. That's just the human beings, you know, and there's always going to be a bad egg everywhere. But that's overall, I think people coming in are decent. They're fleeing war, they're fleeing horrible situations, and we're doing our best as a country to be welcoming and sympathetic and to look after people, because I thought we were a country of immigrants ourselves not that long ago, and we know the pain of having to leave your homeland to go elsewhere because you don't have any other choice. So we get that as a country. We really get that. But I think overall, when you think about, say, between 2017 and 2019, we took in roughly 3.5 international protection people, right, over 2 years. We took in the same number in less than half a year this year. So that's the scale of the increase. So when you take that into account and what we've been dealing with, overall, I think the impact has been minimized as much as possible. But of course, you're going to see it. You're going to feel it because the numbers are huge. But we're not alone in that. Every country in Europe is dealing with this, and some more than others. I think those countries bordering Ukraine, Poland, for example, have taken in 10 times more than we have. So we're not alone.
Yeah, but a lot of the same conversations are happening in Poland that are happening as well.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean? And we had the Polish ambassador on not that long ago that sort of recognised that. Pat, as I say, we'll move on shortly, but just referencing that poll, obviously the majority of people had concerns as to the way the question was asked of them. What does a government have to heed that and say, right, or maybe they are in terms of this 1.5 million we're paying to relieve us of our responsibility of almost 400 people. But what's your view?
I mean, I certainly wouldn't be in favour of a referendum. I do think that it has highlighted the infrastructure deficits which existed before all these this situation emerged. And I suppose what has interested me is that, I mean, we have had 10,000 homeless from pre-COVID, pre-war, pre-all of those things. And the interesting thing is that the government has galvanised itself to deal with the influx of Ukrainians, particularly in a way which it has not done for the, for example, 10,000 homeless, including 3,000 children, for quite a substantial number of years. So I think in a way that has, a lot of people have noted that, and it has raised questions.
Well, can I put it to you just as for the point of argument? I mean, they would say, the government would say, that there is a bed for everyone that is homeless, right? So it's not ideal accommodation, but neither is that for refugees. And that I think we also have to recognise, Pat, that it's a countrywide problem, but the majority of homelessness is in and around Dublin. And that there are, and I've mentioned this on the show before, but there are other challenges, other services that might be required to assist people back into, you know, living in a home. There could be addiction issues or whatever it might be. Do you know, I mean, can we directly compare 10,000 Ukrainians fleeing Ireland, fleeing to Ireland from a war, with 10,000 homeless people that can be on the streets for many, many different reasons and require many different services?
No, of course we can't equate them, but it is interesting that, for example, the grants to do up old houses, which was an obvious thing for anyone walking around towns, right? You could see how so many, Waterford is an exemplar, and yet you need only, in terms of local authority action on this issue, but you need only walk around Waterford to see there are a huge number of buildings which are in need of refurbishment, which could be very satisfactory homes. So yes, obviously the situations are different, but the key point I'm making is that the energy to tackle this problem, which it has been, you know, we have actually put our mind to homelessness. Now, I think there are, in some ways, I cannot understand why we cannot go for timber homes, which are built, which are basically there was a program on it, and basically on one of the islands in Scotland, manufactured in a factory and assembled in 3 days on site. Now, if they can withstand the gales and temperatures in basically the very north of the islands of Scotland, they could certainly be okay here. So in a way, I still feel we have some solutions that we are not considering because it doesn't suit, for example, the building industry. We've had a more lateral approach,
yeah,
but we haven't enough.
And I get your point, and I'm trying to play devil's advocate here, but, you know, when people can't get modular homes because of defective concrete, that's a West. It's frustrating when we can't sort of say, let's build a modular home village for the homeless somewhere, but we can deliver thousands upon thousands of units of housing, effectively, or accommodation for thousands. I think by the end of this year, end of next year, down the southwest. You know, I mean, people go, well, why? Well, that doesn't make sense. And I think maybe even if that was communicated better, it might be more tolerable for people, or there could be an understanding of what's going on.
But I think we've adopted, for example, putting people into hotels has been, as we now recognise, was yet again a convenient solution. It hasn't really, in terms of the tourist industry on the West Coast, it has been a known goal. But that in a way, and I still don't think we have fully mobilised the general public, like at the beginning, the basically facilitating people who had homes to offer. It was a joke.
Well, that's... I have another bugbear on that, because I know many, many people who offered their homes. They were declined. They were accepted. No one was moved to them. And hotels, half of the hotel accommodation in this county is taken up. And I just simply don't understand that, because it would be much cheaper. And you know, I've seen people with food hanging out of their windows of hotels to keep it cool. They could be in some of these houses living at something of a normal life.
But it was a convenient solution, convenient for the hoteliers, convenient for the government. I mean, why do we keep going for what look like handy solutions which facilitate short-term benefits for whether it's the hoteliers, the building industry, etc., and don't mobilise basically the ordinary public, which in turn would help in terms of people, you know, if people have get to know Ukrainians or international asylum seekers or whatever, it greatly reduces hostility, because people think, well, it's, you know, X or Y, and it detoxifies the whole thing. In a way, this has been an own goal by the government in terms of the creation of this problem.
Okay. I'd love to see the integration plan going forward as well, because I think that's going to be a critical part of the future of this country, that we don't have groups of different individuals living in different areas. I mean, any successful rapid change in a population is achieved with understanding of each other and integration, not having sections of towns that become specific to one or other group of people. Would you agree, Andrea?
Absolutely. I mean, in our experience in Doherty, we had about 35 Ukrainians come a year ago unexpectedly. One of the things to a lot of the resourcing and a lot of support has come from community and voluntary sector who have been kind of caught on the hoof. And I know we have as a committee and had to seek fundings to support families in that and try to run classes and with the support of ETB in that. But there just didn't seem to be forward planning. And I would agree with a lot of what Pat has had to say. You know, where do we go from here? How do we integrate these families? And it may be quite a decade before Ukraine will be able to fit enough to take some families back with rebuilding and things like that. But at the minute, you know, the Ukrainians have contributed to our village. They've kept the school open. They are out working in men's shed to build things for the community, and integration and getting the community to meet with these refugees, as has been said, the Irish have been refugees for centuries, and it's time that
is it easier to have that level of integration with people fleeing Ukraine, because we also need to make sure that happens too with international protection applicants that are granted residency here as well.
100%, but it's the mechanism to do that, because I mean a lot of non-Ukrainians are put in centers, maybe isolated from the community, where in our case, you know, they were a small village with very little infrastructure. So, you know, we were kind of just thrown in together, and we had to find our own way, which we have, and they've been a wonderful asset to our community. And, you know, the support, and again, community and voluntary needs more support from government, because we've had to apply for funding, which is competitive, to try and support communities. So, you know, there needs to be more forethought and more, you know, thinking about how do we move on from here.
Margaret says, good old Greg, pulling with the hare and running with the hound. That's good, isn't it? That means I'm balanced, doesn't it? Is that a positive thing? I don't know. Sounds all right. And a caller says, new TDs get full pay while they're learning the ropes. Senators do, so... What do you think about that, Andrea?
Okay. Well said.
Yeah, all right, okay. We've covered that one. Did you see the study, the EU-wide survey on isolation? And it was there was a lot of people surveyed in it. And it found that we have the highest levels of loneliness in Europe. This according to the EU-wide survey on isolation. Sad to hear that, Andrea. I mean, obviously working on a programme like this and much of it covering rural Ireland, it doesn't come as a surprise. And as I said on the show yesterday, I think through COVID, we all got a taste of isolation and loneliness, and perhaps we shouldn't forget that as we try and move forward. But we need to do all we can, Andrea, don't we, to try and relieve that. It shouldn't be beyond us.
No, and again, my discussion before with the Ukrainians, you know, a lot of the supports are provided by the community and voluntary sector. And again, our funding, a lot of it is competitive. We have to apply for it. So in the case of Doherty, you know, you do see incidents of rural isolation, the rural way of life changing. I mean, we've lost the post office, which was a huge social outlet for people to meet. The health centre is gone. The Garda station is gone. We were going to lose our shop only for the sake the Ukrainians came. The school was going to close. So there's been huge changes and ructions in rural Ireland and cuts to infrastructure. Transportation, for example, we have an ageing population. We have young people. We had like six young people had left the area to go to Australia. So, you know, we're an ageing community. What we have tried to do is set up things like Men's Shed, which was very successful. We had a heritage group that met on a regular basis, looked at old photographs to try and engage loneliness affects mental health as well, and which can affect physical health. So you have issues of stroke, and the impact is there. It's one of the hardest group to reach is men.
Yeah.
And we have been trying our darnest to try and engage with the local men. But my call would be more of a recognition to what local people on the ground are doing and supporting them.
Yeah, and Lisa, I think there's a lot of stuff out there. We can always do more. It's about connecting the people with it, you know, and that came through in a lot of the texts yesterday. People were very keen to get involved in stuff, but it's actually signposting them to it and getting them connected to it. And if there's a role for local link to play in getting them to it, maybe that we could look at that. But I mean, I think this is very fixable, Lisa, if we coordinate it correctly.
Yeah, like it has to be, and it's really sad to read that, but also not surprising. I mean, I live in a very rural part of the country as well, and grew up in the countryside, and our way of life has changed a huge amount in a very short space of time. You know, life used to revolve around mass and going to church and the local pub, and those things aren't as, I suppose, people aren't going there as much, and the rural pub is in decline as well. So when you take away those kind of hubs of activity, where do people go to? And I understand it's more affecting men than women. That's not surprising in other ways as well. Women are maybe better at staying in touch with friends and connecting and maybe getting involved in local groups. So I think we need some sort of a task force to look at this, to try and identify, how can we get people out and about, to give direction to local communities. Here are some tried and tested methods that you can use, because community groups will do this for themselves. But it's about kind of identifying how do we go about addressing this. And I don't think we know the answer to that yet.
Exactly. And I see Age Action are coming out with an initiative, but you have to sort of be engaged already with Age Action to sort of benefit from it. Now, they're looking to expand that out.
It's chicken and egg stuff, really, isn't it?
Exactly. Yeah. And unfortunately, just a minute to you, Pat.
Yeah, well, you need resources to basically be maintaining relationships, whether those are with the community or with friends. And the difficulty is that often those resources are not available. It is significant that one of the most successful initiatives has been Men's Sheds, which is providing a context for actually traditional versions of masculinity. Women have solved this problem, for example, many middle-aged and older women. See, swimming is free, right? Okay. Walking, but it's impossible in the country to walk safely on small roads, but walking is also free. So in a way, the key element of creating venues, areas, facilities which are free. And by the way, on average, the report which I'm looking at, it says on average, women are more likely to be lonely. So you can't just forget that. Young people are also, they highlight, very likely to be lonely. And of course, if you're basically living at home, your mates have gone to Australia, whatever.
Will you follow them?
You have very little money. You have no facilities for young people to go anywhere unless you have a dedicated. You're living on your own, you may end up taking a taxi. That's €30 each way before you start having a night out. I'm sorry, it's resources.
Okay. Pat, thank you so very much indeed. Professor Pat O'Connor, lovely to have you on the programme. Senator Lisa Chambers, have a lovely weekend. Thanks for your time today.
Thanks, Greg.
And last but certainly not least, Dr. Andrea Redmond, artist and community developer worker. Hopefully you'll rejoin us. You will, Andrea?
I would love to. Thank
Excellent.
You very much, Greg.
Fantastic. Have a lovely weekend. Take care. All right. Thanks for all your comments coming in. We'll get to some of those after we take a break for the news and obituary notices.